It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
It may be months away, but already the acts for this year's National Folk Festival are being announced. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. 2019 will be the second year the National Folk Festival will take place in downtown Salisbury. Last year, there were over 350 artists that included musicians and craftspeople. Take a look at the first lineup we have in our studio this morning, Laura Botanelli. She's the executive director of the National Council for the Traditional Arts. Also, we have Caroline O'Hare, who is the local manager here, and Blaine Wade, who is associate director. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So, Laura, let me turn to you first and give us an overall view of what we expect to see at the festival.
Well, we're very excited to be having the National Folk Festival in downtown Salisbury again this year. And so for 3 days, the downtown comes alive with traditional arts from across the United States, representing a vast diversity of art forms and traditions that have been carried in communities that express cultural traditions and really showcase the heart and soul of America. So the environment includes 7 stages, performances, dance, a family area, a marketplace, food and eatery opportunities, a vast folk life area with artist demonstrators. And so it is very much an experiential event where you can come in and you can be exposed to incredible music much of it may be new to you for the first time, or an old favorite that you've been beloved by your family or community that you can get up and close to. So the event over its 3 days is a real driver of activity and energy for the downtown, economic development, and really just a way that the community has come together to celebrate culture and the arts from across the United States.
Now, this obviously has a long history. It gives some sense. It reaches back the 1930s or so?
Yeah. That's right. So this is the 79th National Folk Festival, and it has had different models over those years. But that it travels now as pattern every 3 years to a new community. And it's awarded by a selection process. And so Salisbury put forth a very competitive application to be the host city. And when the National Folk Festival leaves after its 3 year stay, the model is that a local festival is left in order to continue to celebrate traditional culture from the host community. Some of your listeners may be familiar with the Richmond Folk Festival, which was a past national site, and their Richmond event is extremely very much a model for the way in which we were able to ensure success in the host community with their successor festival.
So, Caroline, I want to turn to you. And this is obviously, the second year, I guess, for Salisbury. We got one more year, but then obviously we're going to continue on. What kind of impact has this had in terms of how we're putting on the festival? I know it was a little rainy, I think, the last time out.
I didn't notice the rain. That's so strange. We've been prepping since the day after the last year's festival, and we're moving forward with year two. We've had amazing success stories from last year's festival. We've seen an incredible economic impact of about $18 million in the area of direct transactions, with $1.2 million in dollars returning in the next 12 months just from people coming and experiencing the Eastern Shore and saying, wow, this place is amazing. So we hope to not only have a repeat of that success, but also to grow that success. And we have all these indicators that are showing that this year is going to be even bigger and even better.
Anything, by the way, that we're doing differently than, say, once we did last year?
Well, as you plan something and you continue it every year, you tweak and you modify, you see what worked, what didn't work, what needs to change. And we've been doing that again, meeting with all our committees, meeting with our volunteers, with our team leaders, with different local members of the community, with local businesses to see what worked for you and what didn't, so that we can, again, we always have that opportunity to improve and to grow, and we're definitely taking that.
So we're going to turn now to some of the acts that have been announced, and we want to turn to Blaine here. And so first of all, just an overall sense about some of the musical acts that we're going to be talking about. They really certainly vary in terms of the cultures, the places that they come from.
Sure. I mean, what we do with the National Folk Festival, it's a celebration of how we collectively define our nation at any point in time, from the longest standing residents, indigenous communities here in the country, all the way up through new immigrant communities. We like to say it's a snapshot of America at any given point in time to really capture that rich tapestry and wealth of experiences. We also, it's always the finest traditional artists in the country, and the National is never a repeat program. I'm sorry. So it's always artists who were not here last year. They're always new artists who have not been to the festival before, and that's a way of really celebrating and bringing as much diversity and as many of the nation's finest traditional artists to the festival as we can.
So let's take a look at the first one, Adonis Puentes and the Voice of Cuba Orchestra. Tell us first a little bit about its history and what you expect to hear.
Sure. This this group is led by, obviously, Adonis Puentes, who is one of the finest young Cuban band leaders out there today. They carry on the sound of classic Cuban son music. It's one of the foundational traditional music forms in Cuba. It's the basis of all that came after in terms of salsa or timba or what have you. And this is a tradition that comes out of the island's Afro-Cuban heritage, combining African rhythms with Spanish canción or the Spanish song tradition, and really emerging at around the late 19th century after the abolition of slavery, and people are beginning to move from rural areas into urban areas. We have this really exciting rural-urban interchange, and you have a string tradition that's starting to emerge also with hand percussion, but then this really fascinating element comes in during Prohibition. Americans are coming down to Havana, bringing with them the sounds of jazz from the day, and that layer gets added on to the texture of Cuban son music. And so you have these wonderful horn sections added on to the string traditions and the hand percussion. And that really comes to be one of the defining sounds of Cuban son music. And really, a lot of Americans may associate that sound with the Buena Vista Social Club, which is, in fact, what has impacted artists from Adonis's generation as well.
Let's hear just a little bit of it with Adonis Puentes and the Voice of the Cuban Orchestra.
Pues ahora café. El beso de la mañana tenía sabor a café y el aroma de recuerdo del tiempo que se nos fue. Ha pasado una jornada y sigo queriéndola a usted. Melodía y sentimientos salpicados de café. Pero ¿por qué será que a tu lado, vida mía, no tengo miedo?
Before we leave that voice, tell us a little bit about Adonis' personal history.
Sure. He comes from the small town of Artemisia in western Cuba. He comes from a musical family where they grew up. Across the street was the Casa de Cultura, which was a community center, a cultural center. His father taught there, and he taught Adonis, as well as his twin brother Alexis, how to play guitar and sing from a very young age. The two of them together went on to join different national ensembles. And from there, Adonis ends up, he's now in Vancouver, Canada. And he migrates there and has had amazing success. He's been nominated for one Grammy, as well as several Juno Awards. Those are the Canadian Grammys, essentially. And as I said earlier, he's really come on to be seen as one of the leading soneros of today, and one of the great young band leaders. We're thrilled to have him here, and he's going to do great sets on a number of stages, including the dance tent, where people are going to get up and move and have a great time.
What a turn to Morocco. And we have the Nova Ganoa, I think it's called. Tell us a little bit about this particular kind of music.
Sure. Ganawa music, or the term Ganawa, refers to both a style or a musical tradition, as well as a cultural group, a group of people. And these are descendants of sub-Saharan Africans were forced to migrate in the 11th century up to Morocco, where they were brought as slaves or soldiers. And due to that migration, that crossing of cultures that took place because of that, what you have are mixing, it's a Sufi tradition, so it's mystical Islam, but taking the solo devotional singing we associate with Arabic music and mixing that with the call and response more commonly associated with sub-Saharan traditions. It's a musical form that's key to rituals that are part of community and individual healing purifications through. It's a trance music that puts people in a state of mind that helps them sort of rid themselves of spirits and reach that level of purification. The ensembles are led by master artists who are referred to by the honorific title of Malam, and they know this vast repertoire and often play a sintir, which was a bass, a three-string lute, and have a chorus or a kuyoy of singers who accompany them in that call-and-response style while also playing a karkab or handheld percussion castanets. So it's this really richly textured music meant to bring about trance and bring healing and purification. So it's got this fascinating history.
It also, by the way, it also celebrates, I guess, Saturdays. Tell me a little bit about that. Go ahead.
Sure. It's a Sebatian, and that is... What that is in Morocco, there was a close relationship between the Gnawa community and the Jewish community in Morocco. And it's a special repertoire, and the Malam in of Gnawa, Malam Hassan bin Jaffer, he's very knowledgeable about this particular repertoire. And it touches on that shared cultural connection between the Moroccan Jewish community and the Gnawa community. And they do that in celebration of the close bond they had with the Jewish community there in Morocco.
Let's hear a little bit of it. It does have a certain African quality to it. Even things, for instance, I've heard out of, say, South Africa, that there's a certain commonality, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, I think across a lot of music from that part of the world, call and response structures are very important, as well as the strong rhythmic element, and even in the playing of the sintir. It's a very heavily rhythmic music that has a very pulsating and that hypnotic element also ties back to the trance, that it's a music that's supposed to put you in trance and help have that community and individual experience.
So let's turn to a little more of an American, one of my favorite kinds of music, which is, I guess it's been described as soul blues or blues with Eddie Cotton Jr. Tell me a little bit about the kind of blues we're going to hear here.
Sure. You know, blues is such a rich tradition. You have Chicago blues, Delta blues, Piedmont blues, West Coast blues, and one of the forms that's really come out, and I'd say the latter half of the 20th century, and was really popular with, in particular, continues to be very popular with the African-American audience, is soul blues. And that's the tradition that takes the gritty guitar work we associate more commonly with blues and combines that with the smoother gospel-influenced vocal stylings of soul and R&B. So it's got, you know, a couple of different elements that going on, and with when a master musician in that tradition like Eddie plays, it really is designed, it moves the body and the spirit and really just fully engages you lyrically through the different textures of the music. So it's going to be nice to bring that as sort of a contrast to what we had last year with a great St. Louis musician like Marquise Knox.
I was reading it. Sort of the goal is to, I think, find the pocket, I think, is how it described that spiritual kind of transcendence. I think the quote I saw was the music just pulsates in everyone's mind and heart. Just tell me how that works from this music.
Sure. I mean, that's a phrase Eddie draws on a lot anytime he's talking about the music, about getting in the pocket. And that's just when he and the band find that find that right groove together and are able to build that connection to the audience, and the sort of boundaries there that aren't disappear. And it's, you know, it's something Eddie comes from a deep church tradition in his family, which I can talk about in a sec. But it's the same thing that happens with the church when the idea, and it's a Pentecostal tradition that Eddie comes out of, with getting the Spirit and feeling moved by the Spirit. And so it's just when the music and the audience are just connected and it's experience of transcendence, and you've just found that sweet spot. And everybody's right there together.
Let's hear a little bit. About Eddie's own personal background.
Sure. Eddie comes from Clinton, Mississippi, which is very near to the capital of Jackson. So he's not from out of the Delta. He's more from the south central area part of the state, as I mentioned earlier. Coming from out of the Pentecostal church, specifically the Church of God in Christ. His dad was a minister and got Eddie his first guitar at the age of 6, not meaning for Eddie to go out and play blues or anything, but for him to play in the church band, which Eddie was doing by the age of 8. Continued to take on a much more involved role with it. And Eddie's got this great story, actually. When he was 18, he had developed quite a reputation in the area for his work playing with the church band. And without really seeking it out, was offered a scholarship to study music theory at Jackson State University. Got the call, thought, okay, I guess so, why not? And went and did it. And what's so fascinating is he gets there not having really any experience playing the blues yet. And he immediately recognized in the 12-bar blues structures and whatnot that he's learning at school, oh, well, this is just the congregational songs I was playing in church growing up. And so he likes to say that's the deepest blues I've ever played is what I played growing up in church. So he had that really strong foundation. He goes to Jackson State, comes out, goes back to being the minister of music at his church, which is he's still doing that today. But at the same time, he starts going around Jackson with the patriarch of the local blues scene, a gentleman by the name of King Edward Antoine, and works his way up, went on to win the International Blues Music Challenge in Memphis in 2015. And now he travels Europe playing blues. He's playing in the local casinos down in Mississippi, which is a big opportunity for blues performers down there. But on Sunday, if he's not out on the road, he's still at church, leading the church band and participating in the ministry.
And we're going to shift a little to Jerry Douglas, a trio. And I guess it was basically a steel guitar.
Yeah, so Jerry, I like to say, how often can you say when you bring somebody to a festival that you're bringing the best to ever play the instrument that person plays? Well, that's true with Jerry, and that instrument is the dobro. And the dobro is basically a steel resonator guitar. It's a guitar with a metal resonator that's played with a slide. It was became popular during the Hawaiian music craze in the 1920s and 30s, and eventually was picked up by blues and bluegrass musicians. And it's something Jerry was exposed to. He grew up in a Rust Belt town in Ohio. His father was a steel worker who played bluegrass on the side. Took his son out to see a Flatt & Scruggs concert. And that's where Jerry discovered the playing of the great Uncle Josh Graves, one of the great bluegrass dobro players. And Jerry saw that and said, you know what? That's what I want to do with my life.
Let's hear a little bit about it.
Thank you.
His style has been described as being rich in tone and lightning fast.
Yeah, I mean, Jerry is, there's really nothing he can't do with a dobro, but that's really how he's made his name starting out. And he started in bluegrass playing with groups like the Country Gentlemen, J.D. Crow in the New South, transitioned into being a session musician in Nashville. And from there, he's just broken all kinds of boundaries. He's influenced everything from rock and roll and jazz to blues and Celtic music, mainstream country, even done some classical music collaborations with Yo-Yo Ma. He's played with Paul Simon, Bela Fleck, Reba McEntire, Ray Charles. Just so much that Jerry's done. And just to touch on some of the many, many awards he's been recognized with, he has 14 Grammy Awards. He's received 28 International Bluegrass Music Association honors. That's the highest award given out by the bluegrass community. And he also has a National Heritage Fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts, which is the highest honor our federal government gives for folk and traditional artists. And he continues to receive really high acclaim for some of his more recent collaborations, including the Earls of Leicester, a group he's put together. And he's a co-director of BBC Scotland's acclaimed Transatlantic Session. So it's just so exciting to bring him here. And due to his wide, his great versatility and wide range, all kinds of exciting collaborations are in store for audiences when Jerry hits the stage.
I want to turn to Aurelio Martinez. Describe for me Central American in terms of music, but not traditionally what we think of.
No, it's Aurelio represents a fascinating story. He comes from the Garifuna. He's a member of the Garifuna people. The Garifuna. And the Garifuna are, he's a great musical ambassador and champion of the Garifuna, and they're a culturally threatened people and culture who currently they're based along the coast of Belize, Honduras, Guatemala, and Nicaragua. But it's a really fascinating story. It's an African Amerindian culture group, and they're the descendants of Africans who landed on the island of St. Vincent in 1675 after the wreck of a slave ship. There they intermarried with local indigenous groups, the Carib and the Arawak peoples. And then a couple of hundred years later, in the late 18th century, they were deported by the British to Central America, and that's how they end up where they are now. But it's you know, makes it a great challenge to maintain their heritage, their cultural traditions. They've been recognized by UNESCO as one of the masterpieces of the oral intangible heritage of humanity, and it's due to the efforts of artists like Aurelio, who really advocate for and share and help preserve the dance and the music and the language and the culture of the Garifuna. And it's just so great to bring a spirit and a beautiful artist like him who can share that with festival audiences this September.
Let's get a little flavor of that. Just briefly, what is his background?
Sure.
His history.
Sure. So, you know, like so many of the artists we bring to the National Folk Festival, it's in his family. At the age of six, he starts playing drums and social gatherings, and then he made his first guitar out of fishing line and driftwood. Meanwhile, his father has moved to New York City, where there's a large Garifuna community, and he's sending tapes back to Aurelio, and that's how he's teaching himself. And at the same time, his mother is also a respected singer and composer who he often pays tribute to in his performances. So he has that family foundation, and then he went on to be mentored by the great Andy Palacio, one of the other wonderful Garifuna musicians. And Andy tragically passed away suddenly about a decade ago, and Aurelio has really picked up the mantle and carried forward. One other really interesting note about Aurelio is he was the first senator of African descent to serve in the Honduran Congress. That period passed, but he's still performing wonderful music, advocating for Garifuna culture, and he's just celebrated his 30th anniversary as a performing artist.
Finally, in terms of music, let's turn to Hot Club of Cowtown. It's been described as combining, I guess, two 1930s traditions.
Yeah, and it's all embedded right there in their name. The name Hot Club of Cowtown is a reference to the two of the bands who really are identified with the styles of music they play. First, you have Western Swing, and that's Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys. And then you have Hot Jazz, and that is Django Reinhardt and Stefan Grappelli of the Hot Club of Paris. And that's what Hot Club is really touching on. And there's just so much amazing individual talent in the trio of musicians who make up this group, really charming together on stage. You have Alana James on fiddle and vocals. She grew up in Prairie Village, Kansas, started playing fiddle and violin at a young age. But it was when she responded to an ad in the Village Voice that she met a guitar whiz, Whit Smith, who's known for his vintage tone and impeccable style. They came together with slap bass player Jake Irwin out of Tulsa, Oklahoma, another Western Swing hotbed, and have just ever since been the preeminent Western Swing group out there playing the music.
So, well, let's hear a little bit of it, and then I'll come back to it.
Fires in the gray, clocks on the mantel says it's getting late. Curtains on the window, snowy white. The parlor's blessing on a Sunday night. I'd a red, I'm plumb fool about I'd a red. I'd a red, I'm plumb fool about I'd a red.
One of the things that strikes me, by the way, is that the fiddle really plays this sort of prominent role that sort of slips in and out. Very much, I've heard that, for instance, in bluegrass music as well, that really plays that prominent role.
Oh, sure. And there's, you know, so many different flavors in how they play, but Alana's fiddle making is right there. And, you know, really, I think that's one of the great things about the two traditions they're drawing on, is because, you know, also touching on the influence of Stefan Grappelli and his great violin work with the Hot Jazz sound, and bringing that into what they're doing with Western Swing music, which is really at the core of the foundation of it, because Western Swing was a combination of country string band music and old-time fiddle traditions, again, back to that pronounced role of the fiddle, but merging that with the big band jazz that was so big back in the 20s and 30s.
I want to turn, by the way, to a couple of other acts. Dancers. Tell us a little bit about, I guess, the Jones Benelli Family Dancers. What's that about?
Sure. So this is, as the name says, it's a family group, three generations in one family, led by the family patriarch, Jones Benelli. This is a group coming to the festival from the Navajo Nation outside of Flagstaff in Black Mesa, Arizona. And Jones Benelli, the family patriarch, he is what's called a Hatali, which is, it's a singer, it's a dancer, and it's a healer. It's a community leader, and it's something that was passed on to him from his father and grandfather. And a big piece of this is the hoop dance tradition. And Jones Benelli is a multi-time world champion of this tradition. And it's, so you've got 5, 9, up to a dozen hoops, and he's bringing them sort of up from the ground as he's dancing, with his feet, and incorporating them as he goes, adding more and more hoops, and really in doing so, replicating different images or figures from the natural world, whether it's the wings of a bird or something like that. But it's all tied to these efforts at touching on community, shared culture, and bringing about healing.
And then we go around the world, as it were, and Asho Tamil tradition out of India. Tell me a little bit about what we should expect to see there.
Sure. So this is a great young group coming out of New York City, Yamini Kaluri and the Carnatic Ensemble. And Yamini is a Kuchipudi dancer. Kuchipudi is one of the 9 classical dance forms from India. It's what's called a dance drama. So it's telling stories from out of Hindu mythology about gods like Shiva and Krishna. And so mime and expressivity of sort of in terms of facial gesture, it's subtle, but in a way that conveys story, is very important. And she'll be joined by a trio of musicians playing Carnatic music, because this is a South Indian tradition, and it's on mridangam, which is a double-headed barrel-shaped drum, and violin, and a vocalist, and it's in that dynamic between performer and vocalist that so much of that storytelling component comes across, and we're just really thrilled to have him. Yamini is a rising star in the Kuchipudi world. She's come to the States after living most of her life in Hyderabad, India, and has really started to turn heads with what she's doing in New York City. This is going to be one of her first major performances at a festival like this, so we're really excited to bring her to audiences here in Salisbury.
Well, we've been speaking with Blaine Wade. He's the Associate Director with the National Council for the Traditional Arts. Also, we've been talking to Laura Bottinelli. She's the Executive Director, and Caroline O'Hare, who is managing locally. And we appreciate you guys stopping by and chatting with us. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. The Ocean City Film Festival returns in March. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. It's the third year for the annual event, which will screen more than 100 films across five venues from March 8th through the 10th. Over those days, there will be 12 genres, from feature length to short horror to social commentary. There will be local filmmakers as well as those from across the country participating in the event. And we workshops at the Ocean City Center for the Arts. In our studio this morning to take a peek at what we may see is William Strang Moya. He's the Film Festival's director, and welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So overall, give me a sense about the kinds of films that you're looking at in terms of what people could see. Any interesting trends that you spotted as you sifted through all those films?
Absolutely. There's a lot of trends, and it's actually hard to narrow down. But we got a really wild program going on from the get-go. I mean, we've had such a variety. 100 films, believe it or not, is actually a lot for a film festival, especially a small one on the Eastern Shore. Relatively small. We're growing. But, I want to say at this point, our TV commercial says we have films from all over the world, films for everyone, and films that can only be seen in Ocean City. So it's all about variety, and that is something we pride ourselves on.
So before we get into some of the films, so what kinds of genres are we looking at, and anything stand out?
I don't like to take films under, I view them more as categories. I'm looking as a programmer to more blur the lines as to what genres are in our coming seasons. But we have 12 different categories, and we have animations, short horror. We're predominantly a short film festival, short horror, short documentary, social commentary shorts, short films that make you feel good, experimental films, feature films, whatever else is in the program, if you don't mind me looking at this.
Sure, go ahead.
But yeah, like I said, we got all sorts of stuff. Not short, but not feature length. That's one of our unique categories that draws a lot of attention. Dramatic shorts, even music videos. And I think I listed all of them. Short youth films. There we go. That's the last one. And that's a really cool thing, too, being able to showcase emerging filmmakers while also having something like this year. We have a gentleman who was featured at Sundance and is actually a Stephen Decatur graduate. So we're bringing all sorts of people together to celebrate this art.
So how did this festival come about?
Oh, that's a great question. In 2017, January, I was on a winter break from college, and that was this horrible time of my senior year where I finally realized, wow, I need to start thinking about a job after school. That's horrible. So I reached out to the Art League of Ocean City. I got in touch with Rena and the whole crowd there, and Rena Thaler's the executive director of the Art League of Ocean City. And I said, hey, I'm a film student. I really care about, you know, working in the community and maybe building something, getting artists together. Can I teach a class about filmmaking at, the Art League of Ocean City? She said, sure, because they never had anything like that. You know, the demand was there. So I did that. And simultaneously, being that it was winter break in college, the mini-mester, I had a friend who was trying to shoot his thesis film that month in Ocean City. So I was both his producer and cinematographer. I pulled everything together. And the last day of me teaching this class in January coincided with our last day of shooting, and a couple things fell through. So I asked Rena if we could shoot a scene of that movie in the Art League of Ocean City. She said, sure. And afterwards, I had a meeting with her. I said, well, because we shot part of a movie here, do you think we could maybe show the movie here? And she said, yeah, and that they were even open to the idea of hosting something like a film festival. So I said, you know, I can do that. And mind you, I have never put on any event like this prior to that moment. She just said, hey, we need someone to do this. And I was like, okay, by all means, I would love to. And 6 months later, we had our first season. We had surprising audience turnout. Then less than a year from that, we had our March 2018 festival. Our numbers practically doubled. And this year, we're just even bigger than the year before. And it's truly something incredible to have seen grown and, you know, to pour my heart and soul into at this point. So
let's turn to at least the documentaries. The first one we want to take a look at is actually the Ocean City Beach Patrol. It's a, yes. It's a documentary. And tell me a little, first of all, a little bit about that. I mean, it's about an hour long, and it goes the gamut from when they get into training to some of the events that occur to these lifeguards.
It's a really cool movie. The producer, director, Brett Hammond, he really whipped up a really powerful story. He came to town, and he knew that he wanted to make a movie. He knew he wanted to capture a subject that, you know, was both important to the community and, I guess, not talked about that much. Watching the movie, it made me realize, it made me think about things that I would never have considered when it comes to the Ocean City Beach Patrol. So I'm really happy to have it in our program. And after seeing the movie, I know that Brett worked on it for a very long time. I started principal photography, I believe, in 2016, which was really interesting because in 2016, I was an intern at OceanCity.com, and I actually also shot a little, like, two-minute video about the Ocean City Beach Patrol, so I'm pretty sure we were both filming on the same beach at the same time, these different projects. But he started 2016. I believe he finished it in the summer of 2018 because we actually showed an earlier cut of his film at one of our events in August called Art X. And the earlier cut was about an hour 45 minutes, and he cut it down significantly for the festival to about an hour and 9 minutes, I believe. And it's a really powerful story. He's got, you know, start to finish training the recruits, like, you know, assimilating them from just kids who come to town or all the people that actually get into the Beach Patrol, start to finish through training. And then he even interviews, you know, people who were rescued. Those are really, really unique stories about people who were just, you know, in town for the weekend and just,
right.
You know, had, I think, some really bad luck in the water.
Right. I mean, I think one of them broke their neck and yet was able to recover.
It's wild. You know?
We'll play a little clip here. This is Sergeant Phillips, who tells a story about a child who was lost.
A 12-year-old boy and his uncle on 137th Street that were swimming when we were off the beach. And the little boy got pulled out in a rip. The uncle tried to hold on to him, and he couldn't. And it was right before Labor Day weekend, and obviously he drowned. Sunday or Monday of Labor Day weekend, when I was sitting on 138th Street, I looked out in the ocean, and through my binoculars, myself and one of my beach patrons spotted something floating. And around what was floating were dolphins, and they were jumping around it. We thought it might be the little boy because he hadn't been discovered yet, and it was. And what was really crazy about it was that he stayed in the same area, and that's really unlikely, but that his body after three days, I want to say, wasn't touched by anything, and it was almost like the dolphins were protecting him. But it was such a profound experience in my life to go through that and see that and see the family's pain right there. And it was the first experience that I had with death, especially of a child, which is hard. You know, I have two daughters of my own now, and I can't imagine that pain, that just feeling that pain, knowing what that family was going through. And we all see things in this job that are hard to see, but we all give 110%, and we put ourselves out there when we go out in huge swells, and, you know, you have victims screaming, and, you know, you're just trying to get them in and get everybody home, and it's a good day when everybody goes home.
I think one of the interesting things about the film is that obviously they're kids and so on, but in the end, there is a seriousness, I think, to the profession that we don't really think about when we see them up there.
Yeah, absolutely. It was really interesting to hear the side of the story from, I mean, what I thought was the most interesting thing is how, you know, these people, their job is saving lives, and they do it so regularly that you almost take it for granted.
Right, right.
That this is their job. It's so so intense that they have such responsibility over all the people that go in the water, and how they handle it. I don't know what I'm trying to say here. It seems like the way that the Beach Patrol approach their job, it's, you know, they don't think much of it. I mean, right. Obviously they do, because it's so huge. But, you know, they laugh, they joke, because they're so used to it. And the people, it's like, you know, they just had their lives saved. That was right, the biggest right. thing in the world. And I loved seeing that throughout the various stories in the film.
When it turned out to the strange fruit on the courthouse lawn, which a lot of people have been talking about, particularly this is a Matthew Williams lynching that
yes.
occurred in the early 1930s. Tell me a little bit about what kinds of things inspired this kind of film. I mean, we've talked about, certainly on this show as well as elsewhere, about this particular lynching.
Yeah, no, it's huge, in my opinion. Last year, I'm going to backtrack here. Last year, I had a film that I co-directed with Therese Wise, and it was produced by Dan O'Hare, and it was about the winder marker on courthouse lawn in Salisbury, and, you know, a Confederate marker placed exactly where, you know, the second to last lynching in the state of Maryland happened. And that got a lot of people talking, and I'm assuming through the grapevines it drew a lot of attention to Matthew Williams. So at one point, the filmmakers reached out to us, or I reached out to them. I honestly don't remember. I just remember when I first heard about this film, I knew I wanted it in the program. And I am very happy that more people are talking about this because, I mean, I think it's very important mm-hmm. to acknowledge this history. Because when I was working on my film, it's one of the things that still haunts me to this day is in the Knab Center, in the Polly Stewart collection, there's a compilation, a student years ago in the 70s, they had one-on-one interviews with people who were actually attending the lynching of Matthew Williams. And it's something that'll keep you up at night. And I think the fact that an event like that was such a common and accepted thing in American history at a time, that we definitely need to talk about it because that is wild.
Yeah, right.
So to see student filmmakers, you know, come forward and deliver this story in Salisbury, of all places, I think that's huge. And I'm very happy to give them the platform.
As a matter of fact, well, let's hear a little clip of that film. We have, I think it's Professor Aston Gonzalez, and then Browder Mitchell, who apparently was a reporter at the time of the lynching. We should say that lynching took place. Williams was accused of shooting his boss. Eventually, he was pulled out of a hospital by a mob and was lynched. And here's a bit of a description of what happened.
In the Maryland, My Maryland image, we see Matthew Williams in a very different way. Depicts Matthew Williams without the straitjacket that he was bound in as he was lynched, although it correctly depicts him as having his eyes being blindfolded, his vision being impaired. We see him actually resisting his lynching, and these sort of strained feet, his toes and feet, as well as his hands, are supposed to demonstrate or display his anguish, his pain, the violence of his lynching. Whereas in the background we see a fire that has broken out, that there are members of the lynch mob with weapons or some kind of instruments held above their heads in opposition to held in opposition to Matthew Williams.
They cut him down, dragged him by the rope, tied to the back of a truck to a gas station where the body was drenched with gasoline, and then they dragged it over to the Negro section of the Salisbury, where they dragged it around the little streets there and set the body on fire. And then they distributed in the crowd short lengths of the rope for souvenirs, and they cut off his fingers and distributed them.
So when you hear that description of people doing it, particularly the souvenirs, much less dragging the body, what's a reaction to that here now in the 21st century, in your own generation, was far removed from these events?
I don't think my generation is far removed from these events, to be honest.
Okay.
I mean, these are people's grandparents who were impacted by this. It just makes me wonder if these souvenirs, so to speak, like the rope that was used or the toes and fingers that were cut off of Matthew Williams and taken home, were these passed down to kids? Are these on mantles somewhere? Right. I don't think we're removed from that. Like, why would people mutilate someone and keep that as a sentiment, you know?
Right.
But I don't think we're detached from it. I mean, why can't we talk about the mass phenomenon of how normal it was for a bunch of people in a community to get together and chop someone up and burn them alive just because they had a different skin color? I don't know. It's just it's atrocious.
Right.
Like a group of people committing an act as horrible as some of the worst serial killers. And these people, you know, they're kids going on, and it just builds the systemic, I don't know how to manifest my words right now, but yeah. No, I don't think we're detached from it. I believe in systemic oppression.
Right, Liz. I mean, yeah. I want to turn, by the way, to In the Silence. And this is about sexual abuse, particularly of young women, sometimes, I think, one by their father, other by friends, and so on. Tell me a little bit about at least the producers of this film and the impact you think it has.
I think it's really interesting because, first of all, the subject matter, it's something that I'm sure a lot of people shy away from as filmmakers. And to see this kind of story come from a local source, that's really cool. That's another reason why, you know, we love to give the platform to local filmmakers. The director, producer, Eric, I finally met him recently. I've been talking to him because, you know, he's in the program. I don't know. I'm excited to have him. What can I say? I didn't see the movie. A screening judge watched it for us and accepted it. But he's been moving this around for the past year. I know it played at the Senator in Baltimore. It's gotten some acclaim. And, you know, it's one of those things where you meet someone through the film festival. We kind of built it, and these people came out of the woodwork. So they've been making films, Eric and his wife, in the region for about 20 years now, I understand. So they're going to be a part of our program, and I'm sure you'll be seeing them at our monthly film nights in the future in terms of showing their work, because they have other stuff aside from their End the Silence documentary.
I mean, and I must admit, I mean, I think it's a little over an hour long, and sometimes I think it is difficult to watch or to hear someone went on. Let's hear a clip of Tia Camper. She's one of the people who was molested.
During the summer, when I was about to go into the 10th grade, I remember how weird he was acting. He was acting really different. And it's like he was really trying to get me drunk. This was my first time ever having liquor. Ever. So, when I woke up the next morning, I remember getting in the shower and I kept saying, I feel different. I feel funny. I knew that something just wasn't right with my body. But when I walked into the kitchen after taking my shower, he was sitting there eating shrimp, offering crabs to my little brother. And it seemed like everything was okay. Everything was normal, except for my body. But when I had gotten home that same day, he sent me a text message saying, you're nasty when you had that liquor up in you. And I felt like, oh my God, what happened? What did I do? Just come back. I'm gonna give you some more to drink, and I'm gonna tell you what you did. So I felt like I lost a part of me that I held so sacred. I had plans to save myself for my husband. I felt like I was stripped of my dream for me, my plans. But I felt like it was my fault because I should have never been drinking. I should have said no when he told me that I could sleep in his room.
Anyway, should mention, by the way, this is all part of the Protect Our Girls campaign, which, and it was, as I say, a remarkable film, including discussions about healing, about forgiveness, but also trying to deal with the aftermath of such a horrendous event to take place at such a young age. I want to end on a bit of a more upbeat note, which is 5 days in August. That's the White Marlin Open. Tell me a little bit about that.
5 Days in August is a really cool movie. I think it was made by Nicholas Ruff. I believe he shot it in 2017. And it pretty much follows two or three different boats that, I guess, went on the White Marlin Open, you know, competed in the tournament. And it just tells their story, really captures, I guess, what it's like to be on those boats.
And certainly the people, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's a really cool slice of life, so to speak. And I'm excited. It's one of those movies that you'll watch, and I think in maybe like 30 years, it'll be really cool to look back and just look at this product of its time. But I think it's really exciting. And when we got sent that movie, I mean, how could we not feature it? It's an Ocean City movie. This is a huge thing that comes to town, and everyone knows about it. It packs the place for the weekend. So I know this film had a premiere at the White Marlin Club at some point in the past year, but I'm excited to bring it to town again and, you know, get people talking.
I must admit, by the way, as particularly watching like the filming, and there was a lot of work that went into this. I mean, not only do they had all the shots in terms of obviously being on the boat, they had underwater shots of the fish and themselves. I mean, it was really a very complicated film to produce, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially on their time constraint. I can't imagine being on the film crew who has to wake up an hour or two before the fishermen have to wake up, which is already ungodly early, and just, you know, going out on a boat with all that equipment, especially when I believe there's a scene in the movie where a boat, you know, has engine troubles and they have to move, you know. It must have been a grueling process, but in the end, I think they made a really unique film that tells a fun story.
As a matter of fact, yeah, but one of the, I think the principal, I think, boat on it in the film is the Stalker of Zone, I think, by Curtis McCumber, I guess it is, and which he tried, and he talks about how expensive this all is. I mean, this is not a cheap thing, and obviously in the end he doesn't quite make it in terms of winning anything. But you do catch, in many ways, you catch not only the downtime, which they talk about, geez, really, a lot of sitting around just sort of waiting, but also when they do get a bite, there's this adrenaline, apparently, that takes over. Let's hear a little bit about the clip, and we end with Corey Lednum, who is, I believe, the first mate.
There he is! He's on me! In it!
Come on!
In it!
You got him,
boy? Oh, yeah! Come on! Don't pull my teasers off! Whatever you do, pull my teasers down! Don't let that stretch in!
There's nothing like it. There's no other adrenaline rush like it. It will get your heart racing. Time literally slows down, and you feel like you're moving slower, but you got to be fast. You got to get on them. You got to hook them.
So does that make you want to get out there and see whether you can grab one or not?
I don't see why not. You know, I don't spend a lot of time on boats,
right.
And I don't fish, right. But you know, that movie did excite me enough to maybe like, hey, maybe I would love to go filming on a boat sometime.
Right. And they're real characters. Some of the captains, I mean, they're just amazing.
Yeah. That's what I liked most, is seeing all these, the stereotypical like Ocean City fishermen, watermen types. And it's really cool. And I actually, I knew Kurt McCumber before seeing the movie. I actually was in the Boy Scouts with his son, Colby.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, Troop 261. So I was pleasantly surprised to see him starring in the movie.
So, so if people go to the to this festival, what do you what should they expect to see, and how do they navigate? You say it's more than 100 films. How do you navigate that? I mean, we've got a little program here, but I mean,
well, I would say, I mean, yeah, you're going to see more than 100 films. We got so much stuff. There's got to be something you like. There's going to be a lot of instances that you'll have to make a choice between certain movies. But, I mean, that's what it is. That's how it is with the film festival. And like I said, it's all about variety. We got so much stuff. And we even have workshops, which is really cool.
Yeah, tell me a bit about those.
We have three different workshops, one of which is a panel with some members of the Maryland Film Office. So you can get a lot of insight from, like, you know, I think it'll help a lot of filmmakers who are learning how to market and network and, you know, become more involved in a regional sense. And we have two other workshops about making films. The first one is making short films with Rob Waters. Rob is a very talented filmmaker out of Lewis, Delaware. He has a company called W Films. And he supported us for a long time. We showed one of his movies last year that got a lot of attention regionally. It was called Pietas. It was about this guy having a conversation with this kid, and it was really, really intense. Rob's a phenomenal director. But, yeah, he's really good at short films. He excels at that. He first got into filmmaking from entering whatever Dogfish Head's beer and film festival was, and he won it. He had this really cool movie about a crash test dummy who got blown up. A bunch of unfortunate stuff happened to him, but yeah, he's going to be teaching about a two-hour workshop about crafting a short film. He's done that for us before, and we like him so much that we're going to bring him back. And the other one is by a gentleman named Rob Bell. We met him at the first Ocean City Film Festival. He came out, he showed a movie at One Audience Choice. It was a documentary about the Bernie Sanders movement in Philadelphia and what happened to the supporters once the DNC happened, and pretty much how a lot of supporters actually turned to Trump afterwards. So that got a lot of attention our first season at One Audience Choice. Then he came back last year with a movie called Hoop. It wasn't a documentary. It was like a sort of a social commentary feature film, very inspired by French New Wave cinema, about a young man in Philadelphia who was trying to become a basketball player. And it was a really cool movie. People loved it. He packed the house as usual. So this year, I figured, hey, let's bring him on. Let's have him give a workshop about crafting a feature film, because obviously he does a really good job in documentary and he does a really good job in fiction narrative. So he's going to tell people, you know, his approach to writing and, you know, the craft. And on top of that, he's a writer. Ooh, God, I don't remember what he writes for, but he's writing movie reviews for, like, Netflix or something. And he's just keeping busy, and we're happy to have a professional like him on board with us.
Well, we're talking about the Ocean City Film Festival, which is in March 8th through the 10th. There will be over 100 films across 5 venues and apparently 12 genres. Lots to choose from, interesting workshops we've been talking about as well. And we've been talking with William Strang Moya. He is the Film Festival's director. And we appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us.
Thank you so much.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, DelmarvaPublicRadio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC-14.org.